Log Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Man's Voice here on Sunday, May the 13th, Mother's Day. And on behalf of the panel, we want to send thank yous and love to all the mothers out there. There are some of you who we know listen in to our show, and we appreciate you very much. We are going to have a show this evening about men's health, and we're going to talk about men's health as soon as our panelists arrive. We have two esteemed physicians from Advanced Urology here in Atlanta that will come on board and talk to us about things that men have wanted to talk about, but not necessarily have talked about over the years. But I want to say hello to the panel. How are you doing, sir? Officers?
Doing good, David.
We're doing great.
Okay.
And our host, how is he doing?
I'm doing well. I'm exactly having a great time. I'm looking at the board as it lights up of people wanting to get into our show today, which is a good thing. But we're waiting for the positions. In the meantime, what I would like to do is, I know that Jeremiah came up with, we don't talk enough sports. So, Jeremiah, do you want to, actually, one of the physicians just came in. Let me just welcome him on board. Hello, Dr. Hackey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, sir. How are you? You're live on the Man's Voice. I wanted to make sure that I tell you a little bit about this, but I was waiting for Dr. Patel to chime in, but I don't know. Because the number I have for him hasn't shown up yet, but this is a show of six gentlemen and myself who are around the United States, and we call in every Wednesday, and we talk about matters that we think concern men. And so this week, having you on board is a great pleasure to help us get a little bit drilled down into men's health issues and help our community of men who listen to us. And talk about some of those issues that they seem to sometimes don't want to talk about. And
sure.
I was waiting for Dr. Patel, unless he's changed his number. I don't see him. Wait a minute. I think he just came in. Dr. Patel, how
Hi,
are you?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Hey, Neil.
Hey,
I'm good. Okay, so on the panel, I have my panelists. I was just telling Dr. Hackey, and I want to tell my panel, we have two very prestigious physicians on board with us today. You know, Dr. Patel actually graduated from the Chicago Medical School, but he had a degree in engineering and medicine program with the Illinois Institute of Technology, and he graduated cum laude in his class with a degree in molecular biochemistry and biophysics. So he is up and above the stuff I can put in biochemistry. So welcome, Dr. Patel, to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay, and Dr. Hackey actually has his degree from Florida State College of Medicine. He completed his residency at South in the University of South Florida in Tampa, and so they are right now their studies and are in urology. So we want to talk a little bit about that, but want to open the panel to our panelists and see if there's any questions that they want to start with. What about you, Bruce? I know you told me you had something you want to ask. Why don't you ask it now?
Okay, this is something that comes up a lot, Dr. Hacking, Dr. Patel, but Men don't like talking about it or even thinking about it. Why do you two gentlemen think that there's such a resistance to men having colonoscopies? It seems like something, it's very easy to prevent that kind of cancer. It's easy to get it in an early stage, and the procedure, although is not something you always want to do a lot, men just shy away from it, run away from it. Why do you think that is?
I can answer that, Dr. Patel. In our line of business as urologists, one of the things that we do to a lot of men, usually between starting at the age of 50 to 55, is prostate cancer screening. And, you know, one of the things we have to do as part of that screening is do a digital rectal exam to check the prostate for any nodules. And in a similar way, when you're doing an exam of the rectum versus, you know, a colonoscopy, I think it's just a sensitive area for guys, as we all know. It's an area of unknown anxiety. I think men and women are always in fear of the unknown and have anxiety of the unknown. It's just an area that has been considered taboo for, you know, anyone to really
Do we lose him?
I think
he's nearly there.
Yes. Hello? Dr. Hackey.
Hey, so I'll kind of finish up. Men are usually reluctant to see physicians in general, and at least in my experience, and men generally don't go see the physician until something is really way wrong. And men don't like to do routine things, and also we don't, as a group and as a society, we have this masculine wall we put up. We do it in everything, like just suck it up, wall it off. We do it from everything from football to taking care of ourselves. And in my experience, that is why, men live 6 years shorter than women. They'll last 10 years of their life is more likely to be unhealthier than a woman. And this is because we don't take care of ourselves, because it's not macho. It's not cool. And these sorts of things are just, it's just a stigma of men's health. That's why I focus my care on, not only urology, but also on men's health, because I feel, that it's something that's sorely lacking in our society. And women do a very good job. I mean, if you look at the NFL, they wear pink in, the month of October for breast cancer awareness, and men just, they don't want to talk about it, and it's easier to bury it. I don't know if you guys know this, but, Ernest Hemingway shot himself in the head because he couldn't get an erection. He believed that's one of the core tenets to being a man. It's there. It's real. And it pervades through our society and the culture. The way we treat things is to bury it as men. Another example is the average man will wait 18 months after having a lesion on his penis to seek treatment for removal of penile cancer. It's just something that we just fear the unknown, like Neil was saying. But also we have this stigma against doing anything because you got to suck it up.
Yeah.
Right. One of the top 10 causes of death in men, cancer is number two, I think, and prostate cancer seems number one of the cancers that men seem to have. And my understanding is there is no way to prevent that. Is that correct, Dr. Patel?
Neil, are you there? I'll answer for him, I guess. There's no way to prevent prostate cancer, but there are, definitely potential links, like genetic links. We're finding people who have family members, fathers, brothers with prostate cancer, they have higher risk of having and developing prostate cancer in their life. African-American men, there's definitely some genetic cohorts to this. There's definitely, some risk factors based on your genes. When I diagnose somebody with prostate cancer, I usually tell them to make sure they tell their relatives, male relatives especially, that they can make sure they get their rectal exam and their PSA checked.
What are some of the symptoms of prostate cancer? How would a man know that it's a concern? Other than I know you have numbers you should keep up with, and I want to talk a little bit about the numbers. But how's a young man who's just turning, you know, 30 or something or 40 want to say, I need to go check because I think something wrong with my prostate? What would give him that clue?
So prostate cancer generally has, unfortunately, very minimal symptoms. Some men can get blood in the urine. You can also get pain and burning with urination. You can also get issues with loss of control of urine. And some people get blood in the ejaculate, difficulty with erections, bone pain, numbness and tingling in the legs and the feet. These are unfortunately usually signs of metastasis. Earlier signs are getting more the urinary signs, like the urgency and the frequency of urination. But these can also be common signs of enlargement of the prostate, which is more common for a man to experience. So unfortunately for us, you know, prostate cancer doesn't really have many symptoms until it's really further along. Otherwise, the symptoms would mimic enlarged prostate. So getting your PSA checked and getting your rectal exam every year, you know, is something that I would recommend all men do. And, you know, we've seen the pendulum swing towards, you know, aggressive treatment in the 90s to early 2010s, where, like, the U.S. PF guidelines was a grade F, and now they've moved it back, you know, and now it's where the pendulum swinging to more moderate, where they recommend checking PSA, you know, because we're missing these cohort of men that are higher risk. So the United States Preventive Task Force had recently changed their guidelines on PSA checks.
Okay. I have a caller, a young gentleman caller who wants to jump in. Sir, you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. You're a neurosurgeon, but to continue on the prostate, is there ways to prevent this further down the line, my young age, so I don't have to face these problems in the future?
And how old are you now?
Oh, I'm 19. I'll be 20 soon.
Okay.
So preventing prostate cancer, I don't know I can tell you there is definitely a prevention for prostate cancer. I can tell you that there are other studies that are done at MD Anderson, and they looked at seared foods versus people that are eating seared foods versus baked foods. And there's a general consensus that seared foods have reactive oxygen species in them. When you're eating that type of food, you're more likely to have inflammation. There may be a link, and we don't have strong evidence between red meat and different types of cancers, and prostate cancer may be one of them. My recommendation to try to prevent prostate cancer is going to be to make sure you talk to your relatives about if they were ever diagnosed with it, and making sure that when you turn 50, you get your blood drawn and your rectal exam. And you try to stick towards a diet that is rich in riboflavins. These are going to be things like blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, and, you know, avoiding red meat if you can, and staying away from seared food and red meat.
Okay. One of the things that I've seen recently is enlarged prostate. Dr. Patel, are you on the line there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you well. Can you tell us a symptom of enlarged prostate, or what makes a prostate grow?
Yeah, so, you know, prostate, you know, the function of the prostate, it does a lot of things, but it basically modulates and adjusts our semen properties, you know, things like the pH, the fructose content, the viscosity. And it does that by secreting a lot of different enzymes. And the unfortunate thing is the location in which it does that, because, as everyone knows, ejaculate does come out through the urethra at the time of ejaculation. And so the prostate is involved with making sure that that semen is of the right quality, pregnancy, and the best chance of fertility for the male. And, you know, the prostate does grow over time as it's exposed to testosterone. You know, I usually tell my patients that the testosterone or byproducts of testosterone metabolism feed the prostate and contribute to its enlargement over time. So, you know, some men's prostate, I would say most men's prostates will enlarge over time. Some men's prostate faster than others. But it's usually a function of basically exposure to testosterone over the life of the male. And, you know, the symptoms that may start, usually you'll see it starting in the 40s. You know, I have a few patients where it starts even in the 30s. But in the 40s, what you start noticing is frequency, going to the bathroom a lot during the day, which is usually more than like 6 or 7 times a day. Getting up at night, so the first sort of early sign is getting up at night to pee. Now, sometimes when you're younger, that could just mean that you drink a lot of fluids before bed. But usually our body should be pretty good about holding that urine until morning unless it's a large amount. So, you know, there is the getting up at night to pee. The more frequent that happens, the more severe the enlargement of the prostate usually is. There's an urgency symptom. So, you know, if you all of a sudden feel like you have to go and you feel like you can't make it, you may even dribble a little bit. Or when you get to the toilet or urinal and you pee and you finish and then you double back and say, wait a minute, I got to go some more. That could be a sign of early enlargement of the prostate. Obviously, weak stream. You know, for the older folks in the audience today, I mean, take a look at your stream and see, is it the same as it was 15 or 20 years ago? If it's not that you can't hit the wall or it's a little bit weaker, that's probably from your prostate. So those are some of the signs and symptoms that you would see with an enlargement of the prostate.
And my understanding by reading, there are some procedures now to help someone that has an enlarged prostate?
Yes. And so for the men who do have enlarged prostates, you know, obviously we like to start you on, you know, medications early on. Some of these medications do have side effects over time. And so there's one school of thought that says, hey, do you want to be a guy who's taking, you know, 1 or 2 pills every day for the rest of your life? Or do you want, if it's something that you'd be interested in, more definitive therapy? And so in the past, what we've done you know, as far as surgical or minimally invasive treatments of the prostate is what's called a TURP, or as I like to call it, a Roto-Rooter surgery. Make no cuts or incisions. We used to go in there and basically scrape out the prostate that's causing a blockage in your urethra so that you can pee better, the flow improves, your nighttime symptoms improve, the daytime symptoms improve, and generally most men are significantly happier. You know, sitting through a movie, driving in a car a long distance without having to stop multiple times. Those are all things that, you know, you realize become a huge deal as you have an enlarged prostate. And so what's really been interesting is in the last 5 to 6 years, people have realized that the traditional surgery, the TURP, does have slightly higher incidences of sexual dysfunction, meaning erectile dysfunction, as well as incontinence from the procedure itself could damage the sphincter that we voluntarily control to relax to let the urine out. And more novel techniques have come out where we can basically open up the prostate by a method where we can staple open the prostate. That's called a UroLift. Our practice happens to be one of the largest groups in the country that do it because we believe in it. And basically, we're stapling open the prostate, very minimal insult to the tissue itself, and it basically opens up the prostate like a pair of curtains as you open a window, and it allows the body to pee without doing anything drastic or removing any tissue to make you pee better. And the data is showing that, you know, in 5 years after the procedure, a lot of men are doing great. Their symptoms are much better, and the procedure itself is about 5 to 10 minutes, and we send them home the same day. There's another treatment called Resume, where we use treated heated water vapor that basically we inject into the tissue through the urethra. Again, no cuts or incision. The heated water vapor will basically initiate destruction of the tissue over the course of a few months and allow the tissue to shrink away, and thus it would improve the symptoms of enlarged prostate over the course of time. And so these are treatments that have been out for about 5 years, and they're slowly completely replacing the need for that traditional Roto-Rooter surgery that I mentioned earlier. There's also more interesting techniques coming out on the horizon that we'll be doing soon at our practice. One is called aqua ablation, basically using a robot to strategically remove only the tissue that's causing a problem And it really works well with men with very large prostates who may not be good candidates for some of the more minimally invasive procedures, but it in and of itself is also sort of a same-day procedure. So, you know, there's a lot of great things on the horizon, and these are all to basically get you having, you know, in and out of surgery, very minimal time under anesthesia, minimal intervention needed to the guy, going right back to your normal life with minimal recovery, and a durable recovery, meaning that this will hopefully be all that you need for the rest of your life.
Great. There are six panelists on there. Frank, you want to jump in with anything?
Oh, no. I want to thank them very much for the information they passed out. One of the questions you asked earlier about why don't men show up, I guess I'm one of them. I mean, I've shown up several times. But my wife actually showed up before I did 3 or 4 times. So I thought I could then show up if she could make it 3 times. So I just want to thank them for what they're doing. Thanks for the information as well. I was kind of like twitching when they were describing some of the procedures. So that's the other problem, I guess, with getting us to show up right there. So no, I have no, I don't have a regular. I've got an annual physical that I'm involved with now, but I haven't had any health problems or any time spent in the hospital. So, but I have had that exam that you speak of. At least I think I'm on my 3rd time now. Yeah. So, the digital exam. So, so carry on. I'm all ears.
All right,
David.
Yes.
May I ask him a question? The two doctors.
Sure.
And this definition might be oversimplified or wrong, but I'll say it. I've heard people say that many of the cancers that we suffer from are uncontrolled growth of healthy cells. If that's anywhere close to being correct, why is cancer such a formidable foe that we can't seem to fight very well?
I can answer that. So it's an interesting, it's not necessarily proliferation or of healthy cells. I mean, our body is made up of trillions of cells, and it's constantly undergoing replication. You know, at any second you've got about 1 billion cells in your body already splitting and dividing. And each time they split and divide, your DNA and each of those individual cells split and divide. And the body puts a lot of checks and balances in place, because if you imagine doing those sort of copies 1 billion times every second, errors are bound to happen, right? We are not immune to errors. Our cell biology is not immune to errors. And when those replication events happen and the DNA errors happen, we have checks and balances in place to correct those errors. And if they're not correctable, the body does certain mechanisms to destroy those cells. And so, you know, this could be through various intrinsic pathways where the body's doing its own self-checks, or other extrinsic pathways where we have our immune system that notices something sort of abnormal about that cell. It doesn't look right. Let's take it out. What happens is that, you know, a lot of times the body can only do so much checks and balances. And when enough mutations happen, or certain mutations happen to the checks and balance system where it can't regulate its own self or do it properly, then these cells can grow out of control unchecked. And, you know, when that happens and it keeps going, it keeps mutating. So each time this damaged copy makes another copy, that error is further getting worsened in many ways. So then that cancer cell mutates even worse, becomes more viral, more what we call de-differentiated, to the point where it's really not at all anything close to a healthy cell. It's just something that has found the right time and place to subvert all the checks and balances systems we have in our body. And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's really just, you know, bad luck. You know, there's a lot of before it gets to that point, there is a lot of things that happen in the body to prevent it from getting there. So the fact that a cell line has gotten there is one thing. And there are a lot of things that we can do to control it, and there's a lot of things that we can do that are out of our control. There's a lot of genetics that we do and we do not know about how our body protects itself. There are certain individuals who just have poor genetics and they're more prone to cancers, and there are other individuals who live to 110, drink and smoke every day, and they don't have it. And so, you know, there's a lot of things, like I said, we can do to prevent it. Exposures to different compounds and chemicals. Smoking is highly linked to a lot of cancers, and I think that has to do with a lot of the compounds and chemicals in the smoke that help along those cells to mutate and damage the DNA in certain ways. Exposure to chemicals, nerve agents from the war, all those things can cause it. You know, processed foods, seared foods, like Dr. Hackey was talking about, you know, all those things come with a small price. And as you add that up over exposure levels over the course of your life, I think those are the things that contribute to turning what is a healthy replicative cycle into something that could be cancerous.
All right.
Okay,
go
thank
ahead.
You. Thank you.
Okay, that was Bruce. All right, I want to, we have a large audience of young fathers, and so there are a couple of questions. I keep getting these emails, and one of them was testicular cancer. And so in my mind, you said earlier, I think Dr. Hackey, that we celebrate women's diseases, and there's breast cancer month and things like that. Is testicular cancer as prevalent as breast cancer, but men just don't know about it, or we just don't care to know about it, or is it not a big major cancer among men, like one in a million or something like that, or is it more prevalent than that? And how do you...
It's not that common.
First,
oh, go ahead.
Pardon me?
It's not that first, common.
It's not that common. Okay.
That's the problem. It's not that common. You know,
oh,
around
okay.
1% of men will, 1 to 2% of men will get testicle cancer.
How do you test for it? A man.
Usually a physical exam.
Pardon me?
Usually you do a physical exam. You know, you can do a testicular self-exam, and men should be doing a testicular self-exam every month. usually we'll do an exam in the office, and we can do an ultrasound, and we can do blood work to look for different biomarkers in the blood for testicular cancer. But, you know, usually your signs of getting testicular cancer are going to be like painless swelling of the testicle. Right. It can also be swelling of the veins in the testicles themselves. Those can also be, especially if they're new onset, that can also be a sign of testicular cancer. Usually, when you get other symptoms like, you know, blood in the stool and, you know, trouble digesting and dirty spread. But testicular cancer in general is something that, you know, it's very treatable, and there's a lot of chemotherapy agents that we can use for it as well, you know, alongside that. But it's not as common. We don't see testicular cancer as common as prostate cancer.
Okay. A lot of questions are coming in about erectile dysfunction. What it's across the board. How do you know that you have it, and why do you have it, and what are the Let's see, the way they're going is, how do you know you have it, and what is it that you can do about it? Dr.
So the definition of erectile dysfunction is the inability to get or maintain an erection satisfactory ejaculation, right? So how do you know you have it? You're going to experience it. I'm seeing a bimodal distribution of erectile dysfunction in men. At this point, I'm seeing a younger cohort of 20 and 30 year old men, and I'm seeing this older cohort of 50, 60 year old men. The younger men are coming in with erectile dysfunction, and some of them do have issues with the blood flow to the penis, and some of them have diabetes, right? And uncontrolled diabetes can affect the nerves to not only the penis, but also to the eyes and everywhere else, the hands and the bladder. And we're seeing another cohort, 50, 60-year-old men where the blood vessels to the penis are hardened and the arteries don't open as well. So in order to get an erection, you have to have, blood flow into the penis, and the emissary veins have to keep the blood in, and the nerve signal to send that artery to open also has to work.
And so, you know, we're seeing this bimodal distribution. We're also seeing the effects of pornography in the younger generation because they're hypersexualized. And so, you know, some men will come in, they're like, I'm 20 years old and I have ED, you know, and, you know, it's fighting through the symptoms of, do they really have erectile dysfunction, or is this from hypersexualization of our, you know, 20 and younger men, because, you know, they're being exposed to things and things are being thought of as normal. They're being exposed to stuff they normally wouldn't have. So.
You said hypersexualization. Can you define that for us?
So what we're seeing now in some, not all, younger men, they're getting exposed to pornography, and they're getting exposed to explicit pornography all the time. And what happens is there's two types of erections that you can get. There's a reflexogenic erection, which is when somebody touches your penis and it's arousal to you, and then you get an erection. Then there's the erotic thought erection that comes from your mind, but it also can be stimulated by sight. So if you're looking heavily at sight and you're using sight heavily during either masturbation or intercourse, then your body comes to rely on it like caffeine. And so what happens is your body's like, wait a second, I'm missing this visual input if you're just with a partner and there's no, you know, images or pornography playing at the same time. And sometimes, you know, both women and men, especially the younger women and men, are being exposed to pornography, which is essentially, you know, just a show. And some of it is, well, all of it, most of the most part, staged. So people don't get an understanding of what a normal, healthy relationship is like. And that can be damaging, and that can cause, you know, erectile dysfunction, because men and women, you know, are having a trouble, younger men and women, maybe having a trouble communicating and saying, this is what I'm seeing, but is that normal? And also we're seeing some of this in movies and stuff like that, like people doing things that you just, I mean, it's just not common etiquette to do. You know, they're getting exposed to more explicit things. And if they think that's normal and it's arousing to them, regular intimacy is not as arousing because they're stimulated to other stuff now. And that's the danger. So I actually prescribe pornography to some of my patients. I tell them, look, I think you need this to involve, you need to involve your partners with this to, like, you know, help them understand touching and different things and different approaches. But when it becomes a replacement for a relationship is when it becomes essentially a problem.
Well,
kind of a sensory overload in some degree?
Essentially, because you're using your visual senses over, you know, your sense of touch, your sense of sight,
right,
smell, everything
right.
else, you're just relying on that. And if you're focusing heavily on visual, and men are very visual, if you focus heavily on that, then the other stuff gets drowned out. And that's kind of what,
yeah.
you know, we're seeing as far as this bimodal distribution. Some of the men coming in just simply, you know, just need to be rerouted and say, look, you need to take it easy, you need to start using mirrors, you need to calm down with, you know, the pornography, and, you know, start going back to, you know, just using touch and a lot of foreplay. And then, you know, I usually try to give them something to help them, like a low-dose Cialis or something to get their, you know, their courage back, because what can happen is you can lose your erection, and then that is devastating, because a guy will then have the anxiety of, am I going to lose my erection the next time? Then what that does is it makes the partner think, does this person not desire me? They just lost their erection. They don't think I'm desirable anymore. Is it me? Is it them? Do they not like this? And it could be the person saying, I need to hurry this process up because I'm going to lose my erection. And the other person is like, well, I don't get any pleasure out of this. The relationship is now, you know, this intercourse is no longer enjoyable to me. And that's the problem. So, you know, you need to make sure we go back and we address those things.
All right. Don, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. And, Doctor, I'm so glad you're elaborating on the subject that you're explaining right now. What can we do as older men to intensify that erection?
So I recommend cardio. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think
no,
go
ahead,
Doctor.
I'm sorry.
No worries. I recommend
you
cardio.
You want me to repeat my question?
Sure. Go ahead, repeat your question.
Yeah, let me repeat. What can we as older men be about 65 years old do to increase our erection ability also with diabetes too.
Okay. Good question. I recommend, you know, you control your blood sugars because that can affect ultimately your cholesterol level and the nerves to your penis. And also doing cardio. You know, you want to be doing, you know, you want to be getting into the gym or going out for a run and, you know, making sure that you get the blood flow, because to get an erection, you need to have good blood flow to your penis. But cardio makes sure your heart has the ability to squeeze and get that blood into your penis. To get an erection when you were 18 years old, you know, the pressure is 1,000 PSI. That's higher than your blood pressure. So that's the first step. The next step is the treatment pathways for erectile dysfunction are going to be pills, Viagra, Cialis. These are now available. We can get them generic from compounding pharmacies and things like that to try to cut down on the costs. There's something called Muse, which is a jelly or a tablet that you can insert into the urethra that can cause erections. There's also injection therapy, vacuum erection devices, and the penile implant. And on the horizon, there may be linear shockwave therapy, although the data is not back yet on if that's usable, but that's the 50,000-foot view of things you can do to improve your erections.
Okay.
So I would ask doctors, what do you think the number one for that question? A guy comes in your office, is it the pills? Is it the what would you recommend first? And if, what which way would you recommend it? I would assume it's pills. So which one? And
yeah,
what's the difference?
You know, I'll check a testosterone level if a patient has symptoms, because 17% of the time, if a person has low testosterone and they have ED, it can be a reversible cause to raise up the testosterone again. You know, as long as they have symptoms, I'll check testosterone when they come in, and, you know, I'll discuss with them about checking the nerves and the blood flow to the penis, and then, you know, the first place to start is going to be pills, but I always tell patients that diet and exercise can never be replaced. You know, those things are always going to, you know, make sure the arteries can open and close, you know, which is really important to get the blood flow to the penis, and also make sure your heart is healthy enough to pump the blood everywhere. So, and also, you know, making sure that you're healthy, and it keeps the rest of your body in check as well. So, you know, diet and exercise, and, you know, the Viagras and the Cialis, you know, are great places to start, although they have wicked side effects sometimes. Viagra and Cialis, you know, Viagra, headache and blue vision, Cialis, low back pain. You know, and there are other newer drugs out on the market, albeit they're weaker. But usually, yes, start with pills and then move on to the other therapies one at a time. You know, and sometimes some therapies aren't amenable to men. I'll be honest with you. 40% of the men that fill a prescription for Viagra or Cialis will not refill the refill on there. So the dropout rate is pretty high. It actually gets higher for Muse. It's around 50%, and it's right around 50% dropout rate for injections because, you know, you got to sit there and you got to inject my penis before I go have sex, and it's just really, really difficult pill to swallow. And then the next step is, of course, vacuums and the penile implant.
Doctor, you ever heard of Sildenafil?
Sildenafil, that's the generic for Viagra.
It's the generic for Viagra. Why not Viagra instead of generic?
I actually prescribe generics all the time. Our pharmaceutical industry has really taken advantage of men for years. You know, the Viagra pill now costs $25 a pill. I will write for generic. I can get it for very cheap. You know, I just use a compounding pharmacy, which is sildenafil citrate, and I'll get the 100 milligrams of the sildenafil citrate. But everybody knows it as the brand name, Viagra. And I can get generics of basically anything compounded. You know.
All right. Got a caller on the line.
I have a question.
Go ahead. You said that.
Doctor, how long can you expect, and I'm speaking of a person similar to my set, I've got pretty much perfect health without any major health incidents. and sexual performance. What? How long? How many? And I'm actually in the 71 year category, so I'm looking at my what my future might look like. And I exercise.
So, I mean,
I exercise, and so you know, I'm physically fit.
I mean, it sounds like if you're 7 years old and you have great erections and you would continue to have, you know, good, very good erections, and you'll have a slow decline, and that decline is going to be linked to the blood vessels and the arteries into your penis, you know, and
okay.
controlling those are going to be really important, making sure that you get your annual physical to get your cholesterol checked and your blood pressure checked. And unfortunately, a lot of blood pressure medicines we give do cause erectile dysfunction. But as you get older, because your arteries are going to inherently harden because of the diet we have in the West, you will
okay.
see you're going to see a slow decline of your erections. And you know, I've got I've got men in their 80s and 90s that are still having intercourse regularly. You know, sometimes with the help of Viagra or Cialis. But just remember, your penis is a muscle. You know, and working it out is really important. You know, just like any other muscle. And if you don't use it, you lose it.
I'll remember that.
Can I parlay on Brent's question and about using the muscle or losing it? What role? What healthy role does masturbation fit into all of this, doctors?
Neil, do you want to answer, or you want me to?
I Tark, you're the expert here. I'll let you take this one.
So I actually tell my patients that I'm very comfortable. I think it's a healthy, normal thing to masturbate. I think it's very good, you know. But the part where I get, you know, nervous is when patients tell me that they're no longer intimate with their partner. So I think masturbation definitely has a role. And but the problem is you don't want to supplant or replace, you know, having intercourse with your spouse. If that's the
right.
case, then that's negative. It's kind of like anything. You can abuse anything, right? But if it's used correctly, you know, it's a stress relief. That's essentially what it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, you know, or unfortunately, the best stimulation you're ever going to get is from self-stimulation, period. The best orgasms and ejaculation you're going to get is not through, you know, intercourse. It's going to be from masturbation, just from the stimulus, because you know what you need at that moment. Where the other person does not. That's why, you know, having intercourse regularly is good, because then you can figure out what you and your partner both like, and you can get better at it. Kind of like your penis is a muscle, you need to practice with it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you said, doctor, is that having a partner and intercourse is better than the masturbation?
No, I think that masturbation is definitely good. It's when if you have a partner. And if you are avoiding your partner because of masturbation, then that is bad. Otherwise,
right.
you know, masturbation is good, and some men don't realize that you can still ejaculate even if you're not fully hard if you masturbate. So that can be useful, especially if you have, you know, severe ED and you're like, oh, my God, I can't ever penetrate anything. What am I going to do? You know, and that's something
yes.
that, you know, some men experience, you know, in their lives from other surgeries or other issues that they have. But, intercourse is what the penis was designed for, but masturbation is definitely useful. You know, it definitely strengthens, you know, the muscle and pulls the blood in and just stress relief. But, you know, it can be something where it can take you down the road where it can be slippery slope if it's replacing, you know, intimacy with your partner. That's where I think it crosses the line of saying, okay, you have to slow this down or stop this because it's replacing the real thing.
Well, as a quick aside to that, I wanted to tell you that I'm also a submarine person, and it used to be that we would have doctors on board submarines, but I think they took the doctors off because we would get interviewed, I think, once a month about our sexual life, which on board the submarine, and masturbation was the big issue. And so I think the submarine people kind of exaggerated the amount of times that they would masturbate because they were, and this was in the early 60s, that were trying to determine how long a man can stay at sea without, you know, another female aboard, et cetera. But, so it was kind of funny because we would stand in line and, you know, are you talking about an hour, every day? You know, we would kind of exaggerate the amount of times that would happen in our lives.
That's interesting.
All right. I want to jump in because we have a caller on the line who wants to ask a question. Sir, you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have a question specifically for the neurologist and the correlation between testosterone and the decay of the bridge between the size of the brain over time. And, like, are they developing what meant that? Because I was taught that it can lead to Alzheimer's and dementia throughout a lifespan. Like, the more testosterone, and that's why men reach dementia or Alzheimer's before men.
Somebody's alone.
So testosterone is not linked to dementia in any way. Testosterone is the primary driver in men and women for sexual desire in the brain. Testosterone does a lot of things, and I prescribe a lot of testosterone, but it does not cause dementia. It does not cause prostate cancer. It can change your cholesterol panel, and it can affect other things, but having a normal, healthy testosterone level is actually very good. You know, and ways you can raise your testosterone are going to be, you know, cardio and also weights. You know, making sure that you're tearing the muscle and you're exercising regularly. But as you get older, your testosterone declines. If you look at the AUA guidelines, the European guidelines, and the FDA guidelines, the recommendation for testosterone replacement therapy is having symptoms of low testosterone, which is going to be low libido, low energy, and a testosterone value of under 300 nanograms per deciliter. And you have to have both of those symptoms or both of those criteria in order to give somebody testosterone. And when I give testosterone to somebody, I make sure I go through the healthy list of things that they're going to encounter, and dementia is not one of them. I think the prevalence of dementia may be related to other things that we're seeing in society, maybe related to diet, maybe related to other toxins, metals we're exposed to, things like that.
I got it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'd also just add a couple things there. You know, there's recent studies that are coming out now that shows a healthy level of testosterone may in fact, you know, reduce your chance of prostate cancer over time. And they're actually finding in men who had low T and were replaced, their incidence of prostate cancer was less. So there is, you know, and on a side note, just back, you know, on the erectile dysfunction comment and ejaculations, there's also recent studies that are showing that men who who have a healthy ejaculatory pattern, whether it's masturbation or sexual intercourse, that, you know, more than 20 times a month is associated with decreased lifelong risk of prostate cancer. So, you know, sure. Being a man and doing what men enjoy doing, you know, as long as we can facilitate that as we get older and things change in our lives, I think as long as we keep trying to do what we've always wanted to do, I think, you know, there's a good chance that, at least from a prostate cancer risk standpoint, things can be reduced.
Good points. Thank you, Neil.
I have an email here that says I am a weightlifter and I was injecting testosterone, and someone told me that too much testosterone turns into estrogen and I would be feminine.
Well, that's true, right? Testosterone is converted into dihydrotestosterone, and that's what Dr. Patel was talking about earlier, causing male pattern baldness and enlargement of the prostate. It's also converted into estrogen. So in general, I put men on something called an estrogen blocker, like Novadex or letrozole, and anastrozole, to block the estrogenization or conversion. Something else that's missed and is very common is testicular atrophy, because the brain is turned off while you're taking exogenous testosterone. And there's something we can give called HCG. You can take small shots of HCG to keep the testicles and prevent them or slow down that shrinking process. But in general, that is correct. You can take testosterone, but you should be followed because you can get breast tenderness, breast enlargement from rises in estrogen. And that's why we check these lab values, and that's why I see patients every, you know, 3 to 6 months and making sure I'm closely following their estrogen levels, and also sometimes their dihydrotestosterone and testosterone levels to see, you know, you don't want to go too high, you know, but, you know, find that right range, you know, is really important. But it's a good question.
Is there a such thing as too much testosterone in a man?
Yes. There have been a few deaths And these are bodybuilders, and I think they have a body image dysmorphic disorder where they're over-injecting testosterone. I've actually seen vials of bodybuilders come in, and I can actually see it, you know, kind of like strain out when we take their blood because they have, their levels are too high. That can be dangerous, you know, when you get that thickening, that really, really thick levels of testosterone or high levels of testosterone can cause thickening of the blood, which can cause stroke. These can also, you know, cause other problems like sleep apnea. You know, so high levels of testosterone, you know, will make cholesterol levels worse. And you can have a lot more side effects if your testosterone levels are really high. The more common thing that I see is thickening of the blood. And the way to treat that is just donating blood. If you just donate blood regularly, you'll bring the levels down.
Okay. We have a young gentleman on the panel here. Jeremiah, do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
I don't have any questions. He's covered everything really good. But no, I don't have any questions. Probably in a few years I will.
Since I'm an old salty dog, I have another question.
All right, sir.
All right, doctors. How much havoc can your inability to handle stress do in your body, whether it's sexual performance, whether it's just normal bodily functions, your overall health, your ability or inability to handle stress? How important is that?
I think, you know, stress management is huge. Large amounts of stress can alter your natural hormonal balance. You know, many different, you know, there's a massive balance that's going on. Things like cortisol, a lot of different sort of stress released hormones from your adrenal glands, from all over, that can negatively affect your normal processes. And when these normal processes go out of whack because of uncontrolled stress and that can depress your immune system. It can depress excretion of certain important hormones that cascade down to formation of testosterone, even to the level of certain compounds that will help with erections. And so I feel that, if you've got uncontrolled stress in your life, it's important to do stress reduction therapies, as best as we can do without medication to reduce these stresses. So things like yoga, meditation, those sorts of strategies can really help. And I do talk to a lot of my guys about doing that because, you know, you do see stress playing a very important role in your overall health, and not just men's health, but overall bodily health. And everything is linked. And so, you know, sometimes just stress reduction strategies alone can significantly improve your well-being.
All right. I have an email here that asks the question, is there a way to correct blood flow in the body if it's not going in the right directions? I think we talked earlier about blood flow, for erections and things like that. So the question is there a way to get the body I'm trying to read the email here. It's kind of written kind of strange. And it says, is there a way to get blood flow in the areas where flowing has stopped?
So sometimes the arteries don't open to the penis or the veins are leaky. So it depends on what the cause is. If your arteries don't open, we can try to open them with Viagra, Cialis, or the generic versions, Muse injections, and the vacuum will hold the blood in there. And you can use a ring, cock ring, to make your penis and keep your penis hard. Or we can go around having the blood flow. You can have an artificial erection. There are other things that are being trialed that don't have FDA backing, and there's no studies backing them up, or there's no legitimate studies that are done right now backing them up that are done. But for the most part, we try to open the arteries up by medications or going around the medications by using a device like a vacuum erection device with a cock ring, or putting two cylinders into the penis that just inflate, and it doesn't matter if there's any blood flow. The penis will erect itself and then deflate itself as a mechanical device.
It says these pills and things are temporary. Is there not a way to make it permanent?
So stem cell therapy and linear shockwave therapy are on the horizon, and some companies are trying to scam men by using the wrong machine and using therapies that are not either A, FDA approved, or B, have studies. Right now, you know, the only way to permanently go around the blood flow issue is to put a penile implant in, you know, because the device, you know, is, you know, a hydraulic pump inside the penis. It won't change orgasm, ejaculation, or sensation. It just simply, you know, allows you to inflate your penis by squeezing on a ball in the scrotum, and that just inflates you. And you stay as hard as you want for as long as you want, and then you hit the deflate button when you're done.
Wow. We have only a short period of time left. Any other, you guys have any other questions?
Art, can you speak to arthritis at all, either one of the doctors? I guess my question in that is that it seems to be that arthritis seems to be prevalent with humans, and what type of things could be done to minimize its effects or to reduce its opportunity to arise?
That is a great question. You know, arthritis, as you guys know, is just inflammation of the joints. And, you know, there's a lot of things, I think, you know, A, it's a little bit out of our scope, but just to give my two cents, you know, inflammation reduction strategies, proper diet, exercise is huge throughout your life. And, you know, as far as reduction strategies, I think it's sort of a lifelong changes that you have to do to prevent it from happening down the road, because the exposures and the things that we eat over our life, I think, can make your body into a pro-inflammatory state. If you really look at everything that we're doing, I think a majority of what you see in your lifestyle, whether it's diet, exercise, or lack thereof, are contributing to a pro-inflammatory state of our bodies. And I think recognizing those things could have a drastic reduction you know, in inflammation that can cause arthritis and a lot of other things in our body. But, you know, that's sort of my two cents from a urologist talking about arthritis. You know, I think an orthopedic surgeon or sports doc would probably give you a better answer than I did.
Well, thank you for that response.
I got a question here. It said that the doctors mentioned that high blood pressure was a cause of erectile dysfunction. How do you know if your medication is culprit in your issues? So they're wanting to know if they have high blood pressure and they're taking medication, is there a certain strain of medication that they should take or not take?
Yeah, so you know, high blood pressure you know, is common as you get older, but there are a lot of medicines out there like beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, and you should probably talk with your primary care physician or your internist to figure out which medicines you're on, because some of these medicines can cause erectile dysfunction. There are other medicines out there like angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers that don't cause as much erectile dysfunction. And they're also selective beta blockers. So there are different medications out there that do cause and don't cause, and I just tell that person to follow up with their primary care doctor or their other physician so they can figure out which ones cause it, because they can just run down the list and say, look, this one, you know, pretty commonly I see diuretics, thiazide, hydrochlorothiazide, metoprolol. Those drugs are commonly prescribed that cause erectile dysfunction. But also the high blood pressure itself constrain the arteries, make the arteries hardened. So if they have hardened arteries, they won't open. And if they're supposed to open and let the blood flow into the penis, it's never going to happen. You know, your body compensates for years and years and years, and eventually it just, you know, can't compensate anymore.
All right, sir, I got to pull it to the end. We're at the end of the show. I want to thank Dr. Hackey and Dr. Patel. And I want to throw a quick announcement. They are with Advanced Urology here in Atlanta. So all the people who are listening in Atlanta, and you heard the conversation, if you want to look them up, and I know they're in Decatur, and there are a couple of other places. Where are they now?
Sandy Springs, I guess we'll have another office with Snellville and Lawrenceville and Johns Creek.
All right. And we want to thank you for listening to The Man's Voice and listening to Dr. Hacky and Dr. Patel. On behalf of the panel, we want to say thank you, guys, and we appreciate you being here with us on this Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr.
Yes, thank you.
I really appreciate that.
Invite them back, David. Invite them back.
we'd be happy to come back anytime.
We'd be happy to come
everyone
back.
Has a great Mother's Day.
All right. You
happy
too.
Mother's Day, David. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.